We started in the last short Bible study or topical Bible study
last time to talk about the some of the doctrines of the church, and I got started on the doctrine of Satan the devil, which, believe it or not, is one of our primary 20 doctrines of the church. Indeed, we understand him to be a literal being. There are many in the world who view him as simply a kind of a evil philosophy or a direction away from God in general, but not really a person, or we want to call it a person necessarily, but not a literal being. But the Bible describes him in many literal terms as being a literal individual. And last time we talked about a number of things, and I was trying to get through a number of the verses in the Bible on him, and I didn't really get very far into it and realized I've got a lot of verses to cover. But he has his own kingdom. He has individuals in his kingdom. It is set up with angels, and it's characterized by darkness and not by light. Luke 22 talks about his kingdom a little bit as well. In Luke chapter 22 and verse 51. Luke chapter 22. Actually, Luke is a long book. I always underestimate how many, it's got some, 71 verses here in this one chapter. Luke 22 and verse 53 is what I want to read. Luke 22 and verse 53. When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. Indeed, he does have a power of darkness. He has control. He's the prince of the power of the air as well. Let's go to Ephesians 6. I think it mentions him too briefly in Ephesians 6 and verse 12. Ephesians 6 and verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And that, I think, is probably a very good description of his part in these things, or his involvement in this world and his command of things, the prince of darkness and the prince of the power of the air. He controls a lot of things in this world, but sometimes we tend to give him credit for, but I don't think we realize how maybe how actively he is involved in many of those things. Colossians 1:13 is another place that describes him a little bit, but I won't turn there. We also know that under certain conditions, Satan and his demons are able to gain possession and control of human beings and even the animals. In Matthew, it talks about an incident in Matthew chapter 8 where that occurs, Matthew 8:28. It says, and when he had come to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, or the Gergesenes, I guess there's a difference in one account, it's Gadarenes, and I'm not sure they may be different than the Gergesenes. I'd have to look that up sometime to actually see if there's a difference. He came to the country of the Gergesenes. There met him two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way, or no one went by that way because of them. They apparently were somewhat animal-like and attacked people. Chapter 9 and verse 32 of Matthew as well, just over a page or two. I can read that one real quickly. It says, and as they went out, behold, they brought to him a man mute and demon-possessed. They are capable of taking control of human beings. Now, that is not to say that they are able to do so with just anyone. We're told that Satan himself possessed Judas Iscariot in Luke 22, verse 3. But they do have the authority to step in on occasion when someone is willingly entertaining them. And sometimes people do, in a foolish manner, entertain demons. They don't sometimes realize that that's what they're doing by playing with things that are relating to the dark side of the spirit world, if you want to put it that way. People like to fool around with Ouija boards and tarot cards and go to crystal ball gazers and things like that, and they become involved in the occult, and they don't realize what they're doing. They get themselves involved in something that's over their head, and they don't realize that they are entertaining or the possibility of having the dark side come into their life. And they can do that very easily. Jesus Christ in his ministry had the authority, of course, over demons and their followers. He gave power to his followers or to the disciples over them as well to cast them out. Mark chapter 16 and verse 17 tells us that. I'm going to race through some of these and see if I can turn to them quickly and read them. I don't know that you need to follow every single one of them, but it's good to kind of go through a lot of the verses that the Bible talks about this particular doctrine. Verse 17 of Mark chapter 16. And these signs will follow those who believe. In my name, they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will have the authority to cast out demons through God, not necessarily on our own in any way that we have the authority to do that. And that's one of the reasons when it's done among the ministry, we cast them out in the name and by the authority of Jesus Christ. Because none of his ministry had the authority to do that on their own. It is through his name that we do those things. Satan is referred to by different names and different descriptions in the scriptures. Many of those names reflect his character, his evil genius, if you want to put it that way, because and his characteristics. They include the devil, Apollyon, Abaddon, Belial, Beelzebub, the great dragon, the serpent, prince of the power of the air. There are all kinds of names that are used about him or to describe him throughout the scriptures. The prince of the power of the air, by the way, is Ephesians 2:2. I didn't turn there, but that's the location of it. That's a quick summary, I think, about Satan and his demons in general. There's an awful lot we could go into, but I don't think there's a great deal of worthwhile time spent to spend an awful lot of time on him. That's a quick summary. Now I want to look at some specific verses that justify our statement of beliefs about Satan in particular. The first phrase that we got to in the statement of beliefs, which I read last time, I don't think I need to reread it again. What this does is it actually takes it phrase by phrase, and you can see where all of the phrases that we have in our statement of belief actually come from a particular verse. The first phrase was, we believe that Satan is a spirit being. And certainly we derive that from Ephesians 6, verses 11 through 12. And we read that one a little bit earlier. Luke 11, verse 18 is another location that we derive that from as well. Luke chapter 11 and verse 18. If Satan also is divided against himself, how will his kingdom stand? Because you say, I cast out demons by Beelzebub. He does have a kingdom. He has authority. His kingdom won't stand if he is divided. Verses 24 to 26, it also says, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest and finding none. He says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it swept and put in order. And when he goes and takes with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. They can return, even after they've been cast out, if the person continues to entertain that side of things, or the dark side, so to speak, and entertain wickedness in their lives, then they can easily have the Satan and his demons return. Revelation 12, verses 7 through 9, talks about it a little bit. And the war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. So he does have an army, so to speak, of angels. But they did not prevail. Nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So we have an interesting story here about an event that has apparently already occurred. The second phrase that's used in our doctrinal paper is, or our doctrinal statement is, who is the adversary of God and the children of God? He is the adversary of God and the children of God. And we know his name in Hebrew actually means adversary. In 1 Peter chapter 5, we find another reference to him. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, he is certainly our adversary. He walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And he will do so if he's given opportunity. Genesis chapter 3, verses 15 and 16 shows us the animosity that was originally set up between Satan the devil and Adam and Eve and the serpent after the incident in the garden. Job chapter 1 and verse 6, chapter 1, verse 6 and verse 9 and verse 11. There are several verses in Job. Let's go to Job chapter 1 and verses 6, 9, and 11. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them, because he's also one of those, as they're sometimes referred to, Elohim, or the sons of God, or the children of God, or the angels. And then in verse 9, it says, then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for naught? And then in verse 11, but put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. Satan is a master of, he is our adversary, he is a master of deceit, he is a master of temptation, and those are the things that he will do if he is given the opportunity to do so. And that's what he does, and that's what he does best. Revelation 12, where we were before in verse 10, it said, then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. Satan was cast down at some point. Historically, there have been various thoughts about when did this occur. There are different ideas about when it occurs or when it occurred, and I don't know that that's the case or that that we know for certain, I guess. We don't know for certain when he was cast down. The third phrase that we find in our statement of beliefs is Satan has been given dominion over the world for a specific time. And he has been given dominion over the world for a specific time. Matthew chapter 4 talks about that and his authority a little bit as he has his encounter with Jesus Christ. Matthew chapter 4, verses 69, it says, and he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Again the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. If you'll fall down and worship me. He's seeking human beings to be over human beings and for human beings to worship him. He has been given dominion over the world. He was capable of giving what he said he was capable of giving to Jesus Christ. He had the authority to do that, and he had the dominion of this world to be able to do so. According to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4, Satan is presently the god of this world. That's what he is. He has that authority, he has that dominion, and he has that capability to do those things. Satan knows he has a limited amount of time in order to pull off his coup, so to speak, or his attempted takeover of what God is doing, or destruction of God's plan, however you want to put it. He knows he's got a limited time. The less time he finds himself with, the more frustrated he becomes, and the more time, the more effort he will make to attack God's people, to prevent his plan from taking place, to prevent the gospel from being preached, to do anything he can to prevent the return of Jesus Christ, which will mean his undoing and his losing command, so to speak, of this earth. The fourth phrase is Satan has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Satan has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Of course, the beginning of that deception began in the Garden of Eden, of course. Genesis 3, 1 through 5 describes that pretty well, where Satan tells Eve, "You shall not surely die." That's the beginning of the discussion of the first encounter here with Adam and Eve, particularly with Eve to start with, and then with Adam as well. He is the father of lies and deception, and he tells her, "You shall not surely die." And the beginning of his lies and deception, start at that point, although who knows what he was doing, even before man was put on the earth. He may have already been rejecting God at some point at that, for some length of time already. 1 John talks about it a little bit. Let's go over to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. Let's see, verses 7 through 10. Talk about him a little bit. "Little children, let no one deceive you." Certainly he is the deceiver. "And he who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous." Talking about God. "He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Whoever has been born of God does not sin, for his seed remains in him, and he cannot sin because he has been born of God." Trying to remember if I need to go any further here. I think actually through verse 10 is probably the end of this section. "In this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother." And John is trying to point out the difference here. Depending on what your mind is, those who are of this world or of the world's mind are certainly of Satan. Those who are of God don't practice those things, and they walk in a manner that is considered righteous by God or made righteous by God. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1 is another location describing the same thing. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Just want to read verse 1. "Now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons." He is out there and he is working. It clearly shows that he is at hard work trying to deceive human beings and mankind to prevent certainly as many of those who would become the children of God as possible from becoming the children of God. He doesn't want them reigning over him in the future. Okay. 2 Corinthians, also chapter 11. This is a familiar one, I think, to most of us. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3. And then verses 14 and 15 as well. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. "But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ." And there is a certain simplicity in God's way of doing things. There is a complexity in the way Satan designs things. Verses 14 and 15. "And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. He pretends to be righteous, and the world perceives him and many of the things that he teaches and does as being an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." They won't have a pleasant end if it's according to those kinds of works. Revelation 13:14 also shows that the false prophet in the future will continue to deceive mankind right up to the end. Matthew 24, let's go over there for a moment because Jesus himself addresses a little bit about Satan here in prophetically. Matthew 24, beginning in verse 22. He says, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and will show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the very elect. Very important to understand that Satan is striving to do that. Jesus clearly warns us not to be deceived by him or many who will pretend to represent Christ, but who will not be representing him. They won't represent the truth in the future. The fifth phrase that we find in the doctrinal statement is, Satan has ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious spirits, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion. Satan is ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious angels, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion. Jude 6 is maybe one of the best and fastest verses to go to here, maybe. Jude 6 is only one chapter. Jude verse 6. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, or their first estate, I think, as the King James says, but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Informative that this is the time. There is a time coming. Satan's angels and his kingdom have had their opportunity to reign in their rebellion, but they're going to be called into judgment for it. And that time is coming. Jude clearly tells us it's coming. 2 Peter chapter 2. Again, Peter warns and talks about this too. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. He says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, and clearly they have, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. They're going to be reserved for their period of judgment. It's coming. Satan has had his way in the world. He has used his angels as effectively as he can to try to undermine what God is doing and what God's people are doing. And he's going to be removed from power, and he's going to be judged when Jesus Christ returns. Now let's take a look at the three of the major questions that often come up in regard to Satan the devil. I'm not sure I'm going to get time to finish them all, but the same questions always come up about Satan. The first one usually is, will God destroy Satan? People always want to know, well, why won't he do that, or is he going to, or is he not going to put him out of his misery? Why won't God do that? Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14 begins to give us some of the reasoning behind that. God doesn't come out and say exactly, but Hebrews 2 and verse 14, inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, talking about Christ, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. Sounds like he's going to destroy him, doesn't it? Is he? It's an interesting question to ask. People often turn to that verse and say, it sounds like God's going to destroy the devil. However, the Greek word here, destroy, or the Greek word that underlines destroy is the word katargio. Katargio, and it often means to simply make of no effect or make powerless or to make useless. It isn't used very much scripturally at all to imply destruction. The words that most lexicons use to define this particular word are to abolish, to nullify. It's one of my vocabulary ones. I know the abolish, nullify part of it, but I don't know the rest of it. Trying to insert certain words into my Greek vocabulary, and this is one of them. abolish and nullify is how I recognize this word or how I use it. To make ineffective is another means of defining the word. The word destroy is seldom used in connection with it. I think only in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 11, is there any reference to a concept like destroy. So translators have done us a disservice here in Hebrews 2, verse 14, by translating it as destroy. I think human beings want God to destroy. And so maybe that's why they translated it that way here. But the word katargia really doesn't imply destruction. It just means to bring to naught, to nullify, to abolish, or to prevent or no longer allow something to occur. The Theological Dictionary of the New Testament has this to say about the Greek word katargio, which is a combination of the words kata, meaning to cast down or to go down, and argos, which means indolent or useless or unemployed or incapable of action. And that's basically what Satan's going to have done to it. He's going to be incapable of action or doing what he used to do. Katargio in the New Testament has the secular meanings to condemn to inactivity in Luke 13:7, to destroy in 1 Corinthians 13:11, and to take out of the sphere of activity in Romans 7:2. Notice how verse 14 is translated in some other Bible versions, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. That's the New American Standard Bible. The New English Bible has that through death he might break the power of him who had death at his command. And the New Jerusalem Bible has so that by his death he could set aside him who held the power of death, namely the devil. Darby's translation has the word annul here, or to basically to annul. The word is used a number of times in other places to refer to nullifying or to making powerless. Christ redefined the barren fig tree in Luke 13, I believe, verse 7, as encumbering or using up the ground. The Greek word there is katargio, again, not be productive, not be producing, not be doing, to be incapable, so to speak. Some other examples where this word katargia is used is Romans 3:3, will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? That's katargio there. Romans 3:31, do we then make void the law through faith, or ineffective, or unuseful? Romans 4:14. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of no effect. That's another use of the word katargio. So it's used in a number of different places. You can also see Romans 7, verses 2 and 6. Loosed or released from, delivered from, 1 Corinthians 1:28, bring to nothing. 1 Corinthians 2:6, coming to nothing. Chapter 13, verse 11, put away or set aside. Galatians 3:17, make of no effect. Galatians 5:4, become of no effect or estranged from. Katargio is used in a lot of ways of just abolishing or bringing to naught, nullifying. But the destruction part of it is very, very seldom used, and it's even there is probably not, destruction may not be the very best type of translation for it anyway. So the verse in Hebrews 2:14 that speaks of Satan being destroyed should correctly probably be translated as powerless or ineffectual or incapable of doing further harm or destruction. Okay, that's probably a good place to stop.